Okay, welcome back. I think this is lecture 20. And today's class we'll start introduction to optical networking. A word regarding future classes. I think on April 9th we are supposed to have a class, but I think it conflicts with the GM week or Grand Marshal week. Okay, so I got a note and I didn't look at it very carefully, but apparently there is some, I mean, if it falls right on the GM week, probably won't be class. Okay, so just watch out for an announcement whether there's going to be class on April 9th. Okay, I think it's a couple of weeks from now. But anyway, so what that means is that we are pretty much on schedule if you're going to lose a class regarding where we want to go. Okay, so so in this class we start the O part of the class, which is optical networking. As you recall, this class has been renamed as Broadband and Optical Networking. So I should give a fair warning that there is more emphasis on the N part than the O part. Okay, so if you really want to study the optics in more depth, there's a whole series of courses you can take. Okay, physics offers basic optics classes, and then you would take quantum mechanics class. Okay, and then you would take solid state physics type classes, which sort of overlap into material science stuff, but and then it goes into optoelectronics, where you learn about, I mean, things like LEDs, detectors, and modulators in great detail. And there's also another class on fiber optic communications. Okay, so I just want to so there essentially you're doing much more detailed analysis and understanding of all the subtleties of optics. I mean, because optics has this multifaceted character. Okay, just like each of us have a character, optics has a multifaceted character. Okay, sometimes it looks like a wave, sometimes it looks like a particle. I mean, and sometimes you can describe it as a simple wave, sometimes you can describe it like a rays. I mean, it's weird, right? So, but in a real sense, optics is, it's fundamental, because all the life on the Earth has happened because of the energy that the sun has poured on us. Okay, so so there is optics system, and the implications of optical networking and so on is still under great research, and we have several research projects both at RPI and other places on this topic. Okay, so what we're going to do in this class is go through a fairly rapid history of what has happened in terms of optical networking, beginning with its application in telephony. And then we'll sort of sidetrack and get into some basic stuff which you might probably have learned in some physics classes, but we'll try to learn it in the context of what it means for optical networking, what kinds of components you can develop from those properties, where do those properties show up, where do the different models of optics show up. Okay, we'll not bother too much about the quantum mechanical models. Okay, these are the kinds of things you learn in optoelectronics, but we'll sort of limit ourselves to the ray model, the wave model, or at most the electromagnetic model. There are other two major theories of optics, including Fourier optics and quantum mechanical optics. Okay, the book also takes a sort of middle of the road approach, but it's I have taken an even more conceptual view on this class than the book. Okay, books takes a sort of electromagnetic optics type view on the discussion, and of course it goes into photonic discussions from time to time. But there are equations and so on. So my goal here is to offer you enough intuition so that you will be able to read these chapters bravely. Okay, let's put it that way. So chapter 2 of Ramaswamy Shivarajan book is what we're going to cover today. In the next class we'll get into chapter 3, where we'll go into more of the components and so on. Okay, so a quick history of optical networking. It all started around the mid-1950s when the laser was discovered. Okay, and laser is essentially coherent emission of radiation. Okay, and then people say basically there's light, which is can be thought of as a wave or particle, and then light, you can understand how it behaves in free space, and then when it interacts with matter is nothing but atoms and electrons and so on. So photons and electrons are related, okay, there are energies and band gaps in matter and so on and so forth. So as light interacts with matter, its behavior changes. Okay, so there are several properties based upon light-matter interaction. And then what you can do is you can leverage these properties to have some interesting features, like you can guide light. Okay, so people figure out how to guide light, okay, through simple experiments, and then they figure out how to guide light in microscopic dimensions. Okay, and not only guide single wavelengths of light, multiple wavelengths of guide light, etc. And that is the whole field of what is known as waveguides, or more specific specific type of waveguide is fiber. Okay, fiber is a cylindrical waveguide, and it's a long distance waveguide, but you can also have tiny waveguides which sit inside, say, computers and so on. So you can have, or within inside components, or you can actually build optical switches, and inside them you have small waveguides and so on. So we'll study some of this later. Okay, so between the 60s and 70s, the fiber technology dramatically developed. Okay, and people understood how to build waveguides, how to build low-loss waveguides. So the moment you make it low-loss, you can go longer distance. Okay, so to give you an idea, the loss at the critical sort of transmission windows of fiber is roughly 0.25 decibels per kilometer. Okay, which means you can go 100 kilometers and get 25 dB drop. Okay, so which means that you, if that is your budget, you need repeaters only or regenerators only after 100 kilometers. So it made long distance optical transmission possible. And then, more importantly, in 1970, earlier all these lasers were what were known as gas lasers and so on and so forth. These are huge and bulky. Okay. Then it was shown that you could actually build lasers out of semiconductors. Okay. So then it became essentially the marriage of silicon and optics, which the revolution is still, just in the infancy. Okay. So if 1970s through now is the revolution of what is the silicon, there's a famous economist who called George Gilder, who wrote a book a long time back called The Microcosm. It's just sort of a fun reading book, which talks about, it was a futuristic book on what would be the impact of silicon. More recently, in late 90s, he wrote a book called Telecosm, which is what is the impact of optical networking and so on. It's sort of fun read, but basically it is a more popularistic description of all this stuff. So then people understood how to make transmitters, receivers in integrated packages, highly refined, etc. And as these developments made their way into telephony, you started seeing its application in telephony. Okay, and more importantly, after the breakup of AT&T, we saw how we could do time division multiplexing but use fiber transmission. Okay, and you just use on-off modulation, very simple modulation techniques. Okay, in the mid-80s, people proposed to use both as components of LANs. Like, for example, you could take Ethernet, and instead of using a copper wire, you could use fiber, whether in 100 megabit Ethernet or gigabit Ethernet, etc. Or you could actually build a LAN completely made of optical components. Okay, so essentially you use fiber, and then you use what are known as passive or active optical components, which provide some kinds of switching or those filtering and forwarding capabilities, which I talked about long time back, right? So there are, depending upon, because optics doesn't behave like silicon, so there are some limitations on these properties. So the types of networks which you could build, architectures, were also affected by these building blocks. And there were methods like broadcast and select architectures. So you'll be surprised to know that the first transatlantic fiber was laid only in 1988. It's not very far back. Okay. And it is only in the mid to late 80s that a phenomenal development, which we shall study about later, called the EDFA, came about. What is the EDFA? EDFA stands for a weird name. It stands for Erbium Doped Fiber Amplifier. But what it really means is an all optical amplifier. Okay, see, remember the simplest thing you can do is amplify, right? That's the first network component, like regenerators, repeaters. So you can see why we are in this sort of phase. So basically what an all optical amplifier does is it has a flat optical gain region for a large piece of the spectrum. Okay, in some of the crucial spectrums like the 50 nanometer, or what is known as the C band of optics. So essentially what you can do is you can, the bandwidth is tremendous. You're talking about like 35 terahertz or of bandwidth or and those kinds of order of magnitude, like 25 to 35 terahertz of bandwidth, and you have a flat gain for those kinds of regions, which means what you can do is you can take that bandwidth, chop it up into smaller bands, okay, and then send high-speed transmissions on them. Okay, so that's exactly what wave division multiplexing is. Okay, instead of those bands, instead of calling them frequency bands, we call them wavelength bands. You have amplifiers that are not limited to electronics, so you don't have to actually take the electronic signal, convert to electronics, and then regenerate the signal, etc. You can then completely in optics, as part of the fiber, or integrated into the fiber, or sort of spliced into the fiber, you can build an amplifier that amplifies it together, okay, and so on. So it greatly alleviated both the distance limitations. Okay, at the same time, people have been building better fibers to make things go farther and farther and so on. But the amplifier was one of the big things which actually was the enabler for wave division multiplexing. So in the mid to late 90s, the wave division multiplexing systems explode. Okay, and the future wave division multiplexing essentially, remember, like the old telephony systems, you could put multiple calls into a single line. Okay, and this was called concentration in the old days. Okay, this is wave division multiplexing, exactly the same thing. You never hear the word concentrators nowadays. Okay, so similarly in the future, we might not hear the word wave division multiplexing because it might become a small component or an almost unseen component of a larger infrastructure. Okay, so as optics become better and better, there are like significant challenges going forward, like to be able to do low power optics and high speed optics and high bandwidth and so on. But I mean, many of these systems are very high powered systems, and you get into regions where they're nonlinear optics and so on and so forth. Okay, so but what we are going to be looking at is primarily this region of time. Okay, we are going to be looking at basic ideas of fiber optics, basic idea of components, how DWDM as a concept arose, what are the systems, how can you do basic things like ad-hoc multiplexers, digital cross-connects, and then what is the concept of optical routing, all optical networks, etc. And these are basically fiction at this point, but there are components which are starting to emerge which could play a role in these things. Okay, and sometime before the end of this class, I'm going to have a person from industry come and give an invited talk to give you perspective, who has actually worked on an optical networking style company, to give you a sense of what are the economics of all these things and why is the industry actually filled with glut, etc., what's going on, what are the business considerations, and so on. Okay, so as for our purposes for today, the big picture we want to focus on is the fact that what are the basic components. Okay, there's a wire which we call fiber. Okay, but what is a fiber? Fiber is just a way of guiding this wave called light. Okay, so it's called a waveguide. So this is a long waveguide, that's all. Okay, and you have electricity coming in, or basically electronics, and you have modulators, and you're coupling electricity to light here, okay, using some sort of a light source. Okay, and we should see the light sources make a huge difference in fiber optics. Okay, and the light receivers also make a difference. And we'll study light sources and light receivers later in the next class, and these are the subjects of optoelectronics. I'll not get into great detail in this. And you have receivers, you have amplifiers, detectors, etc. So if you look at the system level in DWDM, what are the components of the system? You have several, SONET channels which are coming in, and you map these SONET channels to particular wavelengths, and essentially you have a spectrum around that wavelength. You have some guard bands, and then you have a spectrum around this wavelength. Okay, so these the first generation wave division multiplexing system essentially had about 100 gigahertz difference between these wavelengths. Okay, so that was a gap between these wavelengths. But now the latest systems have only 25 gigahertz difference between these wavelengths. Okay, and you are trying to do OC192 on top of them, which is roughly 10 gigabit per second on a 25 gigahertz band. Okay. Now the interesting thing is, you might say that this is like lousy efficiency. If you look at wireless, and if you look at anything like 250, any sort of coding mechanism or a modulation mechanism like 256 QAM, you try to get 8 bits per hertz. Okay, that is, it's a measure of how much spectral efficiency you're doing. Here you have 25 gigahertz and you're transmitting 10 gigahertz, 10 gigabits per second, which means roughly like 0.5 or 0.6 max. I mean, if you take out the guard bands, 0.5 or 0.6 bit per hertz. Okay, so you're not doing any fancy coding or your modulation here. So there's a lot of way, a lot of room to go in terms of how you can code and modulate. But also this points to a fundamental fact. When you are going at these high speeds, you want to avoid all kinds of processing. Okay. So here's a sort of, I'll just leave you with this intriguing thought that whatever is the sort of whatever was abundance in a generation, okay, will become the scarcity of the next generation. Okay. So in this case, at least computation is the abundance, and in wireless networks you try to do a lot of computation, DSP techniques, and try to extract as much efficiency as you can out of a given amount of bandwidth. Here now, when optical or bandwidth becomes abundant, computation becomes scarce, especially at these high speeds. Okay, so high speed computation is still a scarce commodity, and we saw how this was such a big deal when we were designing high speed routers. Okay, so even when people say computation is cheap, it's only talking about low speeds, and talking about really, really high speeds. At the highest ends, we are starting to approach, and clearly the optical side of things, you don't necessarily want to expend as much computation. So the right trade-off here is you can be spectrally inefficient because there's just so much spectrum. You're talking about 25 terahertz of spectrum, you're chopping it up. So be inefficient about computation. Some point computation will catch up, so you can add to the efficiencies and so on. Okay, so that is the basic question here. So these are the basic multiplexers. This is called an optical mux. And then you have these red components, which are the optical amplifiers, like the EDFAs and so on. And then you have multiple wavelengths going through fiber. Okay, remember that this is a single thread. Okay, it's almost the size of a thread. Okay, the whole fiber itself is only a few microns thick. Okay, so it's much smaller than the size of your hair. That's a fiber, and within that fiber you have 160 wavelengths, and each wavelength carries 10 gigabit per second. Okay, that is the sort of state of the art today. Okay, so it can give you some idea of the staggering dimensions to which technology has progressed. Okay, think of what we can do if we can make this come all the way to your home, right? And that's what we are doing. We're working on such stuff. Okay, so then you can add the systems in the middle called add-drop multiplexers, but these are prefixed with O, which says that it's optical or all optical add-drop multiplexers. So it'll be interesting to see, without converting to electronics, can I do add-drop multiplexing, etc. Then you can truly start talking about optical networks or all optical networks. But there are many of these components where you do, especially if you want to switching, you convert back into electronics, you demultiplex this whole bundle out of every single fiber, get each wavelength, and you put a huge router here or a huge switch here, and then try to demultiplex and switch the whole thing. Okay, so these are types of components. And if you look at the evolution over time, in the early days, you used to use, fibers were used, okay, because they were much more efficient than copper. But the technology in terms of light sources had not developed, lasers were not well developed. So LEDs were used for transmission. Now, LEDs happen, if you look at the sort of power spectrum, they have a broad spectrum, okay? And actually, nowadays, LEDs are becoming much more tighter spectrum and so on. In fact, Professor Fred Schubert runs the, he's developing a new solid state lighting center, and he's one of the world's experts on LEDs. So they are developing much more tighter spectrum, or spectrally efficient LEDs, for lighting applications, etc. But old LEDs had broad spectrum, especially as you go to the infrared side, it gets broader, which was what you wanted to transmit to here. And then what happens is the broad spectrum is what is known as dispersion. When you have broad spectrum, if I take a wavelength from this at this point and wavelength at this point, right, the propagation speed, remember that light travels at different speeds in medium, right, and the speed of light depends also on wavelength, basically because the refractive index is wavelength dependent in general. So what will happen is that, and also you might have multiple modes. Okay, I'll talk about what that means really, which go through the system. So at the end of the day, when you come out of this, right, you're going to see a massive jumble of confusion. I mean, you're going to have your energy, which you transmitted per bit, has dispersed or spread out for a much more longer period of time. So there's a delay spread of energy per bit. So which means that, this is also a common problem in normal electrical networking. So what will happen is if your bit energy spreads, it will interfere with the next bit, okay, or the next symbol, as it's called in information theory. So this is known as inter-symbol interference. So beyond a point, even if you get rid of all the noise in the system, this is a fundamental thing you cannot get rid of. Okay, so what that means is essentially you have to put these components, these are electro-optical components that need to regenerate after some distance. Okay, so the first generation or zeroth generation of optical networks, then you really need to put a lot more regenerators at very small spacing, and these fibers which were used were called multimode fibers. So the earlier lasers were bulky, and they were also called multi-longitudinal mode or MLM lasers. Okay, they had a power spectrum which looked like this. Okay, lasers typically have coherence. Okay, which means that they have a tight spectrum around some point. Okay, so because coherent means that you have tight spectrum, that's what it means. But what happens is that it tends to have tight spectrum around multiple things. So it's like multiple spectral lines. That's why it's called multiple longitudinal mode laser. And then you throw it on top of a 1.3 micrometer system. Okay, this is also known as the S band of transmission. These also tended to be 0.8 micrometer. Okay, so what happened was these were old fibers which did not have great propagation characteristics. It also had huge attenuation characteristics. It was much better than copper, but still not as good as 1.3 micrometer. And then 1.55 had much better characteristics. So you see, there has been improvement both in the fiber side, both in terms of the transmitters and both in terms of which part of the spectrum you use, and in terms of these repeaters and so on. Ultimately, if you look at what you achieve later, is that you operate typically at the 1.55 micrometer band right now. You use more sophisticated fibers, and even more sophisticated fibers have continued to be coming. And you use all optical amplifiers, okay, but the optical amplifiers tend to operate in just one band, so that, and your transmitters typically determine what your investments are. So most of the investments today are in 1.55 micrometer band. And you have these new things which are out there called wave division multiplexers, like companies like Ciena, Lucent, and all of them sell these boxes and throw them on this. Okay, and what you build is today you take SONET, right? So you essentially use SONET channels and then multiplex them onto a wave division multiplex things. And then essentially you have rings, okay, which are fiber-based. Okay, but then you get demultiplexed, and it is handled by a stack of equipment, SONET equipment. Okay, so this is what is known as stacked rings, and I think we described this when we talked about SONET as well as when we talked about survivability. Okay, so that's how they are. Okay, and the lasers have also become better and better. They become smaller. Using semiconductor laser and also the single line, so they have high spectral. And there's only just a single pulse here. In terms of all the energy is concentrated right here. So photonics, as it's called, it's a complement of electronics, the far, far greater field, okay. You can do your own PhD in this area, and a lot of things remain to be done, but it's much more than just optics and optical networks. It can go as much, you can go use nonlinear devices and build optical computers. But this is still an emerging field. It's not much single. Diffraction of light and interference of light, properties of light can be used for other special applications. There are medical imaging applications. RPI has very strong terahertz center, which is looking at one of the far end of the spectrum of light. Terahertz, actually, if you look at normal visible range, it's actually several hundreds of terahertz, like 200 terahertz and so on. But almost 400 terahertz. But when we talk about terahertz, it's like 1 terahertz and 2 terahertz range, which is also sometimes called far infrared or far infrared. Those regions, people still don't know, how the properties are. That's the transition between the wave behavior and the optics behavior. And so Professor Zixin Zhang in physics actually works on that kind of stuff. So those areas, people are looking at imaging applications, and when you come to this infrared bands and so on, you get into communication application. When you go into ultraviolet and X-ray band, again, you get back to medical applications. Okay, so that is the basic idea. So you have RF you have wave behavior, electromagnetic wave behavior. And then you get into microwaves and the transition areas. These are called terahertz waves over here. And then you get into infrared regions, far infrared and infrared, then you get into visible, which is just a sliver in this overall piece of the puzzle. Okay, and it turns out that many of the thermophotovoltaic and converting sort of solar energy into light and solar cells and all that, I mean, the spectrum extends a lot into the infrared regions, and the trick is to somehow take the energy from the far infrared regions and then sort of frequency shift it and make it come into the visible region or sort of concentrate it into any regions you want. So people are working on like fancy things like nanocrystals and so on this for this area. This is just to give you a flavor for what kinds of great things that are going on. So light is still under like heavy investigation. People are constantly discovering a new feature of light. Just in a real sense, it's strange, okay, because it displays multiple characteristics. So when you're talking about waveguides or sort of medium, when you're talking about a sort of macroscopic behavior of light, when you're talking about sizes which are far, far larger than the wavelength of light, you can basically think light travels in straight lines, okay. So there are more sort of specific statements of this, essentially. So, I mean, obviously it doesn't travel in straight line when you cross a boundary, okay. So it travels in the path such that of least time, okay. So essentially those are the kinds of postulates of ray optics. And then you can describe light as a wave to some extent, but you can have an effective description of light to a great extent using Maxwell's equations or electromagnetic optics. But the more detailed behavior of light, when you want to really build devices or when you want to grow materials, you need to understand quantum theory or quantum optics. So we'll be primarily, sort of jumping between ray optics, wave optics, and to some extent particle nature. Okay, so the idea here is whichever is convenient to understand, we'll use that. So there is a well-understood duality between these things. So the wave nature, if I want to really understand reflection in great detail, or a phenomena like interference, it's very hard. I mean, you can't explain interference with ray optics, okay? But you can explain interference with wave optics. And there are some phenomena which ray optics falls off. I mean, so when you want to get into polarization, you can't use basic wave optics. You'll need to use Maxwell's equations, okay, and so on and so forth. So, so light, as I said, has several properties. So the only way we can make sense of them in this class is to sort of try to focus on a few things. Okay, light wavelengths can interact with other wavelengths in free space. Okay, so these are interference phenomena. Okay, once wavelengths, light or particular wavelengths, say monochromatic light, shows up and interacts with matter, then there are several phenomena such as reflection, refraction, and diffraction. Okay, diffraction is very closely related to interference, but diffraction is a particular phenomena of light interacting with matter. So the two ways to understand light, all the phenomena of light, the first question you should ask is it light in free space? Or is it light interacting with matter? And most of the questions come around light interacting with matter. So when it's interacting, you pick up a convenient model, and then there are several aspects of light. Its velocity, its frequency, its wavelength, whether it's a monochromatic, polychromatic, and what is the refractive index of the medium, and how does those properties which are developed from quantum levels, how do the macroscopic properties, how are they dependent upon various phenomena? Are they wavelength dependent, etc., etc.? Okay, so we'll try to cover a few of these things, okay, and we'll just scratch the surface and at a very superficial level. That's a warning. Okay, so the trajectory of light as it goes through, as it goes close to a particle like an electron, etc., it is affected by strong electromagnetic fields, so that's why light trajectory can change and so on. So those can be explained in a particle matter. Okay, so the attributes of interest, at least a few of them, is the fact that it has a dual nature. And light has multiple wavelengths, okay, even though for convenience to understand basic phenomena, we talk about monochromatic light. Monochromatic means single color, chromatic means color, or single wavelength, okay, but in reality, why light, even if it's a laser, has a very short spectrum, okay, around it due to the imperfections. This spectrum actually can be substantial, okay. And light, if you analyze it as a solution of Maxwell's equation, the energy of light is spread out between different directions, both in terms of electric fields, magnetic fields, and the electric field itself has an XYZ orientation, and light is known as a transverse electromagnetic field. What it means is that it doesn't have energy in the Y direction, it just has electric field energy in the transverse direction, that is perpendicular to the direction of propagation. So it's called transverse electromagnetic wave. But even within the transverse electromagnetic wave, there's a difference in how much energy is there in the X direction, Y direction for the electric field and magnetic field. Okay, this distribution of energy is sometimes characterized as polarization. And the interesting thing is, as light interacts with matter, that is light traverses through matter, the polarization might shift, or the distribution of energies, or the electric field orientation, effective electric field orientation might shift. So, and these are known as linearly polarized, which means that the energy distribution doesn't change. It's always circularly polarized, electric polarization, etc. Okay, and you can actually leverage this for your benefit, and so on. Okay, optical power, as I said, is distributed across the spectrum, and it's affected by matter. Okay, you can either absorb it, you can modify it, you can attenuate it, etc. And propagation, the simplest way, the first thing you learn about light travels in straight lines. Okay. Okay, that's good to always, if you forget everything, remember light travels in straight lines. Okay, so in waveguides, it follows bends, okay, because it's guided. Okay, so we'll try to understand how that works. And in matter, it's affected variously. I mean, it can be absorbed, scattered, etc. And at propagation speed, in matter, it travels at different speeds. Okay, now the basic thing is the frequency remains the same, but the wavelengths could change. Okay, so whenever you say wavelength, we typically mean wavelength in free space, because wavelength in matter depends upon matter. Okay, so, and the phase of light, like any wave has both frequency, wavelength, and phase, and sometimes in quantum theory you study it as study wave number, which is essentially spatial frequency. A phase is also affected by variations in fields in matter. So you can just like we do in electronics, you can code your information, all of the stuff, but the basic coding which is used is just on-off modulation. Okay, so just to give you a sense, there are lots of properties when light interacts with matter, and we'll just be touching upon a few of them. Okay, so let me give you a flavor. If a wavelength interacts with another wavelength, that is, light interacts with light in free space, interference. Interference is basic in just superposition of waves, okay, and we should have learned it many times. It's a very simple linear phenomena. Superposition of light. Okay, it happens in free space. You can have interference only at a spatial point. You can have interference here, but the light beams can cross each other at the points here. You will not see the interference, but if you are at that intersection point only, then you will see the interference. Okay, so these are basic ideas. And when you interact with matter, you have a smattering of effects. You can have linear effects, or you can have nonlinear effects. Nonlinear effects typically happen because of two reasons. One is, if you use high power, you get into nonlinear effects. Okay, and we shall describe a few of them, but not too many. Linear effects happen both at high and low power. Nonlinear effects also can happen because the medium is what is known as anisotropic. I mean, so it doesn't have the same properties, particularly refractive index in all the same directions, and it can randomly vary, etc. Okay. So, linear effects such as absorptions and scattering, these are two different effects. But the result of these two things is attenuation. Okay, as far as your signal goes, the signal strength or the power is absorbed by these two things. Okay, it's either scattered away from you, you don't get it at the receiver, or it's absorbed by the molecules, by the atoms. Effects with respect to polarization, there's one important effect called birefringence. Okay. And we shall actually use this when we build optical couplers and splitters, etc., and also in some nonlinear effects. But sometimes it's a harmful thing. And so it's also commonly found in calcite, I'm sorry. So there are other standard things, reflection, we think of it as mirrors and so on, right? But essentially this is light interacting with matter, that's the fifth phase. And diffraction is another light interaction with matter. It's a little more subtle effect. It occurs because of difference in refractive indexes. Suppose I go from refractive index of 1.5 to 1, suddenly the behavior will change. Okay. So, and this can also occur if there are slight refractive index changes as well. and polarization, etc. So there are other nonlinear effects like four-wave mixing, stimulated Raman scattering, and so on. We will not get into some of this stuff, but people are building optical things based upon these effects. Okay, you can build amplifiers based upon this for wide gain. You can actually build solitron technology, which essentially is one pulse that is completely unattenuated. It goes throughout the for long distance, etc. So these are under intensive study nowadays. Okay, so the non-monochromatic light can interact with matter and then other light also. Okay, so these are some of the effects of that. And you can go through, since you have non-monochromatic channels, you can have pulse broadening, as I mentioned. This is a basic dispersion behavior. And refractive indexes, these are all some property of matter, macroscopic property of matter, which affects the propagation of light. And this can be a function of your wavelength or function of frequency and other factors. Okay, so we'll not go into other stuff, but let's sort of try to understand in the context of fiber optics. So fiber optics, first thing, you're putting light into matter. Okay, and the matter is fiber, it's a waveguide. So the optics, the first thing we learn is that you have some core in the cladding. Okay, and these have different refractive index. So what is the magic? Okay, how does the light come here and go out? Okay, so basically we need to understand the basics of how light interacts with matter and how you can use it to guide light transmission at low, and such that the attenuation is very low and the dispersion is low. Okay, so this is the ray optics, as I mentioned, is the basic, it describes the basic behavior of light with matter. So this model of Wright is a limit of wave optics. You can think of it when the wavelength is infinitely small compared to the dimensions you're considering. So we can come up with standard laws of reflection and refraction. It lies in the plane of incidence, okay, the angles are equal, etc. Angles of reflection equals angle of incidence. So what can we do with this? You can build mirrors with this, right? You can build planar mirrors, you can build paraboloid mirrors, and you can build elliptical mirrors to concentrate light. You can build spherical mirrors which have different properties. And paraboloid mirrors are used in conjunction with lasers and LEDs to sort of do collimation, etc. So we learned about micro MEMS mirrors and all these, right? So to understand MEMS technology and so on, all you need to do understand is reflection. And typically, you can still understand a lot of its behavior of MEMS mirrors through ray optics. Okay. So even though you have fancy technologies, the first principles of optics and the simplest theories can be used to explain that. Okay. So refraction of light is that when light can actually get into the medium. Okay, in reality, not all light is ever fully reflected or refracted. Some of it goes in, some of it goes out. Okay, and this is described by a macroscopic law known as Lenz's law, where you have this sort of sine equation. Okay, the refractive index times the sine of the incident angle, refractive index times the sine of the refracted angle, refracted rate. Okay, so this magic formula comes because light goes through the path of least time. Okay, so if you listen to Feynman lectures, right, he has an interesting way of describing this. He says, suppose there's a sea, okay, and you are on the beach, okay, and there is a damsel in distress who's trying to swim, but she's drowning, okay, and you are sort of, Coast Guard, I guess, this is a lifesaver. Okay, so you are, how do you run to save her? Okay, so you want to go such that you spend the least time, right? So you could go in a straight line, but essentially you can run faster than you can swim. So if you actually do the Snell's law calculation, what you would do is you would run at an appropriate angle such that you cover some distance, more distance in this medium, and then you go in this medium. Okay, anyway, just to keep you. So this is a way of remembering stuff, right? Okay, so that's the principle of least time. Okay, so this can be used to do ray deflection, and this is a standard prism idea. And because the refractive index can be a function of the wavelengths, essentially this can be used to separate out wavelengths. Okay, so if you want to build an optical demultiplexer or multiplexer, you can use the simple ideas of reflection fraction. Okay, there are other ways to do this also. So So essentially you take a fiber which has all these wavelengths coming in, essentially collimate it, and then you see it all break up into different wavelengths, and then essentially you can break it up into multiple fibers by appropriately concentrating it. Okay, so this is one simple way of doing demultiplexing, or you just reverse the process and you can get multiplexing. Okay, so this is a simple idea of how you can use the simplest thing you can learn to do optical components. Okay, so the relationship between reflection and refraction is that beyond a point, refraction becomes reflection. Okay, and that is known as total internal reflection. So you have reflections up to a point till you reach a magic angle known as a critical angle, and beyond which you come back. Okay, essentially you reflect back into the same medium. Okay, and that angle is described by this formula. Okay, and this is the basic idea of how fiber optics works. So essentially what you do is, just like a prism, you can have internal reflection, total internal reflection. In the fiber, essentially light can be thought of as traveling through a series of total internal reflections. So basic idea of fiber propagation or wave guiding is that you have to design this the refractive index and the angles at which light comes in, etc., such that you propagate through total internal reflection. Okay, so this is a idea of a waveguide. There are several ways to build waveguides, and one is to have a medium and put a surrounding medium like either thin air or a cladding around it to make sure that there's just total internal reflections. Or in fact, you can have a bunch of mirrors. Okay, in fact, people today are trying to build, instead of having a medium like this, people are actually trying to build a pipe and making light just travel through the pipe. Okay, it's a hollow pipe. Okay, sort of hollow fibers and so on. That's actually the best, but it's very hard to engineer. Okay, so and you can actually build waveguides through a bunch of lenses and so on. Obviously, people are converged on this as the sort of best waveguide possible. So light guiding, the concept of an optical fiber is that of total internal reflection, and this can also be seen if you shine a light source on a faucet and the water comes here and you can see light over here. So what has happened is the light you shown, which you shine here, has shown up over here because of the fact that you have total internal reflection like this and showing up here. It doesn't get out. Okay. Okay. So the way the fiber looks at does it is to have a core and a cladding. Okay. So the thing you should remember is that there is a difference in refractive index, but the difference in refractive index is very, very minuscule. Okay, so the core is built out of a material which is silica, which is the same thing used in semiconductors, etc. Because of its homogeneous properties, okay, it has the same refractive index throughout. Okay, and it has very nice crystalline structure, etc. So that's number one. And then you just add some doping, etc., and build a cladding around it with a slightly different refractive index. And this is related to a concept known as numerical aperture, which measures the light gathering capability. So if essentially I put a cone here, all the light which falls inside this cone at the entry of the fiber will get in, or get coupled into the fiber, as they call it, and the remaining light just doesn't go. And this numerical aperture is actually a very small angle. It's about 10 degrees or even smaller, okay, depending upon these ratios. Okay, the core, you should remember, has a slightly higher refractive index than the cladding. And the way you do this coupling based upon this numerical aperture calculation is you use some sort of a lens. Okay, so there are a variety of lens, like a spherical lens or some Grin lens, and there are some new technologies to do direct coupling, or you try to put this thing. I mean, so this is a very important thing because a lot of energy is actually lost in this coupling process itself. So the way geometric optics... So now let's start understanding basics of how geometric optics can be applied to a fiber and see how you can understand it. So just if you standard ray theory, you have this numerical aperture or some light is gathered. Okay, you can think of it as many rays, infinite number of rays that are showing up here. Okay, but you would think that an infinite number of rays will go into this material and then come out. It turns out that not an infinite number of rays go in. There's exactly a finite number of rays that go in. Okay. That's very hard to understand from ray optics, because ray optics says that any light, anything that goes in should come out, right? But if you study Maxwell's equations, there it has to satisfy something known as a boundary condition at these two points whenever it does total internal reflection. So there are only a discrete set of rays that go in. Okay, this is also similar to quantum mechanics. It's like we have discrete states. Okay, that also depends upon boundary conditions, etc. So there are only a discrete set of rays that can go in that will satisfy the boundary conditions. Those rays that can get coupled, which lie within the numerical aperture and satisfy the boundary conditions, are known as modes. So when I say a multi-mode fiber, is those magical rays that can go in. Okay, but still, what happens is that once you take that for granted, each mode essentially goes through a bunch of total internal reflections and reaches the other side. So in ray optics, you can immediately see that some modes actually do many more jumping around here before it reaches the other side, while the other modes reach faster. But essentially what you did when you said, I want to transmit bit number 1, I basically opened this aperture and said, send light in. Bit number 0, I don't send light, right, if I do on-off modulation. So here what happens is the energy which belongs to bit 1 is now concentrated between multiple modes, and each mode takes different times to go to the other side. So when that energy of bit 1 shows up at the other side, it is dispersed, or it is spread out in time. This is known as a delay spread. This is a standard word for dispersion. Okay. So because different modes, I mean conceptually in this case, travel at different velocities. Okay, or you can think of as traveling different distances. So there is a delay spread or a time difference between the fastest and slowest ray which carries the information of the same bit. Okay. Now if this difference is too much, so essentially the energy per bit is spreading, and it can or energy per symbol, or bit or symbol I use interchangeably at this point, if it's spreading, it can interfere with the next bit. Okay, so that's the key idea. Okay, so the moment you do that, you'll have inter-symbol interference. So that becomes the limiting of how far you can go, etc. So you can use the concept of total internal reflection to understand a number of things. I said that the concept of modes cannot be directly understood, but once you define a finite number of modes, you can essentially figure out how much dispersion there is by understanding just using ray optics. The other thing is fibers cannot be bent arbitrarily like copper and all that. I mean, there is a maximum bend radius, okay, and the curvature at which you can bend it. If you bend it more than that, you will violate the laws of total internal reflection and light will get out. Okay, this is why fiber engineering and optical engineering is a little more complex than saying, because it just depends upon total internal reflection, right? So you can't bend it arbitrarily. You can't make a fiber take a U-turn, for example. Okay, so that's one thing. Okay, and then that is one thing which is at least you can try to keep within. So there are some standards for every fiber. It will have a specification saying how much you can bend it. But what you cannot avoid is there are micro bends. Okay. Now, micro bends are things which are so small in the fiber that you can't even see it. Okay, you have to see a microscope and see the fiber, only then you can see it. Okay, the fiber itself is only 50 nanometers or so. Okay, you can barely see the fiber, leave alone the micro bend in it. So what will happen to micro bend is that at this point, you will lose your total internal reflection, and the mode which shows up over here will be lost. So what that means is that some of your energy which is coupled on the bit is getting lost because of these micro bends. Okay, so the funny thing is that even though you can, this is a negative thing, engineers always find beautiful ways of converting negatives into positives. Okay, so people actually insert micro bends on purpose to get rid of unwanted modes at particular points. Okay, if there's too much modal dispersion, one way to handle modal dispersion is to get rid of modes. Okay, and use higher energy. You just, this is sort of the brute force way, just dump more energy into the fiber. And you know it's going to result in a few modes, and then magically kill modes by just touching micro bends at key points, right? Very fancy. Okay, but it's done. Okay, so far we looked at ray optics. So I'll give you now a flavor of how you can use wave optics or electromagnetic optics to understand this notion of modes. Okay, so the simplest way you can start thinking about waves is if you think of this light or the mode as a wave, right? Essentially, what it's doing here is if you take a small string and you hold it between the two parts, between two fingers, and then basically oscillate it, right? After some time, the whole thing will die down, but assuming there's no friction, what you'll have is what is known as a standing wave, Okay, this is something basic you learn in physics. Okay, so essentially you have oscillations which are governed by boundary conditions. The boundary condition is that the amplitude of the oscillation is zero where you're holding it. Okay? Okay, so that means that ultimately the what sits inside is either a product of the wavelength or a half wavelength. Okay, so there are only some particular frequencies that are possible. Okay, you cannot have, if you look at the frequency spectrum of what are the possible modes, right, or what are the possible frequencies there, only a particular set of solutions. If you model this as a differential equation and try to solve it there, you cannot get all possible frequencies. Only some frequencies which are known as harmonics, actually, which are products of some fundamental frequencies are possible. So modes and levels in quantum theory are also very, very similar, exactly the same principle. You solve equations which have boundary conditions, and as a result, you are forced not to have a continuous set of state, you have discrete states. Okay. So similarly, you have discrete set of modes. Only those which satisfy these boundary conditions of zeros at these points are possible. So these you can view as standing waves. Okay. Standing waves are well understood in wave theory. So, so if you go one step beyond wave theory, it's not just a normal wave or like a wave on water. Okay, but it's an electromagnetic wave. So what is an electromagnetic wave? An electromagnetic wave is something which has simultaneously an electric field and a magnetic field, both of which are perpendicular to each other. So this is the electric field, this is the magnetic field. And you can model this behavior as though it is rippling like this. It's a wave. Okay, so the electric field direction is changing, it's here, then it's decreasing, it's in this way. So this is how the electric field and magnetic field are propagating. And they always exist together. Magnetic field is a result. It's a relativistic result of the existence of an electric field. Okay, if you remember your basic physics. Okay, so if you don't, maybe you should take class. Okay, so these things are described by four beautiful equations known as Maxwell's equations. Okay, the only problem with the equation is that, and if you take a look at the equation, they don't tell you anything. Okay, so you really need to understand the basic mechanisms to solve them, take an electromagnetic course, and understand the intuition between what comes out of the equation. So the entire theory comes out of this. The first thing that comes out of it is that electric waves exist along with magnetic waves. Electric fields, are essentially a three-dimensional thing. For light, okay, if I view this as the z dimension, or the direction of propagation is z dimension, the amount of energy in that z dimension is negligible. Okay, so to a first approximation, you can view all its energy as in the transverse direction. This direction is sometimes known as a longitudinal direction. So all its energy is in the transverse direction. And you have the condition that these two are perpendicular to each other. Okay, so that is why it is known as a transverse electromagnetic wave. Okay, that's where light is, so that's what is realized. And then even among the electric fields, right, there's a distribution of energy. If the distribution of energy among the x direction, y direction of doesn't change, okay, it's known as a linearly polarized light wave. Okay, so that's what it's. So this particular diagram assumes linear polarization. So basically, if you look at it, at the macroscope, if you take electric magnetic field and put in a jumble and look at how it looks like a wave, right? So you can see a wave theory is the sort of approximation of electromagnetic theory where you don't see all the electric waves and magnetic waves, but you just see this overall rippling behavior. And in the two slides back, we saw that you can take the standing wave and approximate it by a line. That is ray theory. Okay, that's a simple way to think about it. Okay, but once you start thinking about waves, you start seeing new phenomena. Okay, so you can clearly understand refraction as the idea that the wavelength changes once you move inside matter. Okay, so once you move inside matter, the frequency remains same, but the wavelength, its velocity, and wave number, which is essentially spatial frequency, are altered. Okay, so this is a fundamental thing. So remember that wavelength is a thing which is only defined uniquely in free space. Frequency is constant everywhere. Okay, so the first phenomenon that is interesting as an interaction of light versus matter something known as diffraction. Okay. Another way of thinking about this is shadowing. How does light actually cross? Suppose the sun is shining and you're not seeing it directly. How is it bright even when you can't see the sun directly? I mean, so one thing is that light actually curves or gets reflected. Okay. And but there are other diffraction is another phenomenon by which some of the energy of light gets coupled around corners. Okay. And that happens because if light were in a vacuum, it wouldn't happen, but because it comes through, it comes in contact with matter, that's when it happens. Okay, so the simplest way to understand it is to take, a non-transparent material, okay, basically a plane, and put a small pinhole in it. Okay, this is a rectangular pinhole in this case, and then put a screen behind it. If light travels in straight lines, right, I put a thing in straight line, I should just get a small rectangular image here. Okay, but the phenomenon called the Fresnel phenomenon is that you have some sort of a blur here, okay, with a very high intensity here, and then you have these ripples here. Okay, okay, this is given the sort of mystical name diffraction pattern. There's a lot of mystique about it, right? So if you look at, all physicists and mathematicians, you maybe draw a plot, okay? Figure out a variable of this, call it intensity or amplitude, and then draw a plot. Okay, it sort of jumps around like this, and there's a huge jump here. So these small jumps correspond to the spatial intensities, and you see the spatial intensities drop off. Okay, if you're a sort of aficionado of electrical engineering, then you know that this sort of a pattern is what is known as the square of a sink pattern. Okay, or sink pattern is basically sin x by x, that is known as a sink curve. Okay, it keeps appearing all the time when you do transforms, etc. So, so then if you take a square of that, so the amplitude is sink pattern. If you take a square of that, the intensity is the square of that. Basically, it's all positive, and you have these points where it goes to zero, and then comes up again, and then it rapidly drops. Okay, the intensity drops dramatically as it goes, but you still have the small bubbles or intensity. Okay, why does this happen? Okay, so this happens, means the property. So you cannot explain it by ray theory. Right? So this also happens if you use a circular aperture. Funny thing is, the diffraction patterns, I mean, if you look at the intensity patterns, they'll also have a sync function, but now it is centered around this and goes in all directions, okay, rather than this. So how do you explain this? I mean, what is really going on? Why do you have this sort of circular patterns, whereas you had this sort of patterns over here? Why didn't you have patterns going this direction? Right? This is diffraction. Okay, think about it. Okay, so this is essentially what we see here. So people have they put the screen here, they put the screen far away and so on. So the diffraction patterns are much more pronounced if you go far away, which is known as the far field. And if you come closer and closer, it starts becoming much more, I mean, you don't see a clear diffraction pattern. You see almost a flat grain and with a small noisy pattern on top of it. So this is known as the near field. Okay, so sometimes this is known as the Fresnel zone of near field and far field. Okay, so similar effects are seen in wave theory. People actually study this both in waves, and the same thing shows up in optics. So what it means is that light behaves like a wave, at least for this case, right? Okay, so interesting thing, before I tell you, explain why this is happening, the interesting thing happens if I don't put a hole or a slit, but I just make what is known as a grating. Okay, and then shine light at it, or make, suppose I have a partially transparent or refractive material here, and just make these small grooves here. Okay, now you can observe this. I mean, this might be hard to sort of abstractly observe, but if you take a CD, right, or a CD-ROM, and shine light against it, you'll see multiple colors which are coming. Okay, why? There are small grooves, exactly the same. There it occurs through reflection, but here it comes through refraction. Okay, you can also see the same thing through reflection. Okay, so what is happening here is that you see different colors. Essentially, some colors means different wavelengths are being reflected or refracted in different directions. Okay, so what this indicates, that this phenomena of diffraction here, I'm using plane waves, this phenomena of diffraction has been studied, and they basically say that it's not something just because light goes through free space. Okay, it's been explained in multiple ways. I mean, at every point in the pinhole, right? You assume that there is another source of light, and like a point source of light, and then you have this also emitting light, and then all of these sources of light interfering with each other. Okay, another explanation for it is at the points where light encounters the non-transparent material, it encounters a refractive index of something very high, so it can't get through the refractive index. But at the point when there is a, when it encounters free space, there's a change in refractive index. So similarly, when you see gratings, you see changes in refractive index. So if you take one material and put another material of slightly different refractive index at different points, right, you see the same effect. So you can view it as though you have point sources of light all in free space, or you can view it as though it is an effect, diffraction is an effect related to variations in refractive index. So when light comes and encounters a variation in refractive index, it displays the phenomenon of diffraction. So that is the most general understanding of diffraction. And pinholes, whether it's round holes or this thing, or whether you put gratings or whether you put small stripes of different refractive index material, all of these are special cases of this explanation. So, I mean, you can use this for multiple tools, okay? You can use this, I mean, the prism type principle also, you can use this to separate out wavelengths. So when you have a multiplex wavelength, you want to demultiplex it, you can use a grating. Okay. Okay, so the other aspect is interference. Okay, now even though the funny thing is, if you look at the experiments which are used to demonstrate interference as well as diffraction, they look very similar, but you should understand, appreciate the difference. Interference is a light phenomenon. Okay, it exists even without matter. Okay, whereas diffraction is a light matter interaction. If matter didn't exist, diffraction wouldn't exist. I mean, or refractive index variation, if it didn't exist, you wouldn't have diffraction. So, but the Young's experiment essentially shows light rays. I mean, you have some apparatus here to set up coherent light. Collimated light and monochromatic. And monochromatic means single wavelength. And these basically show up here as plane waves. And then if you assume there are point sources here, these point sources will interfere with these point sources. I mean, if these are waves, essentially, at these points you have superposition, okay, and you have higher intensity and lower intensity. The funny thing is that total energy is conserved. So essentially what is happening is that the energy is getting concentrated in some parts and it's being removed from other parts. Okay. So this is very similar to how you do in RF as well. I mean, if you use appropriate antennas and so on, directional antennas, essentially what you're doing is you're actually playing a game of interference. Okay, so the actual way you focus a beam is by making sure that in all other places you have interference, and you take away the energy from there and focus all the energy here. Okay, so you can basically play games with interference to direct things. And interference, as you remember, is a superposition phenomenon. It can be described by linear superposition. Okay, and is the energy is conserved. It's the other constraint on interference, and it's a spatial phenomenon. That is, if you go from one point to another point in space, the interference, what you'll see, the energy you'll see is different. Okay. Okay. So, again, I mean, you can see interference of two spherical waves. So on. So it is actually described by a standard equation. It's basically a superposition of two vectors. Okay, so if you take two vectors and calculate what is the amplitude after interference, and then you take the intensity profile, you'll have this sort of cos phi, which is a sort of a phase of this vector. Okay, so. So essentially, interference basically means that when cos phi, when this thing becomes zero, either this can be zero or this can be one. Okay, so that when as cos phi moves from zero to one, either you'll add up this factor or you'll add up some fraction of this factor. So that's how these interference patterns behave. So at these points, lambda, 2 lambda, 3 lambda, etc., you have constructive interference, and this point you have destructive interference. Okay, so remember the words always are sometimes misleading. Okay, you should never take a word too deeply. Okay, or too seriously. When you hear the word destructive, you feel that energy is lost. Energy is not lost. Overall energy is conserved. Okay. So that was in terms of two wavelengths, or if you have two waves, you can also have multiple waves. This particular diagram shows all of them are waves have equal amplitude, equal phase differences, they synchronize in terms of phase and so on. So it behaves, it looks like this sync function we talked about earlier, except that after some point the sync function is regenerated. Okay, this is how it looks. Okay, so sync squared as it's called. So this sine m pi by sine pi. Okay, so these phenomena are used to do Bragg reflection and so on. So Bragg, so you can view this as either an interference phenomena or a diffraction phenomena. So depending on if you have a bunch of mirrors, right, you essentially have reflected light, and these reflected light waves can interfere with each other, and you can get different wavelengths showing up at different points. Okay, and these ideas are used, the interference notions are used in phase lock lasers and so on. Okay, so if I have n monochromatic waves, you can generate monochromatic waves in different ways. One way to do that is to take a laser. Okay, laser is coherent not only in terms of phase, but it also, it has a very sharp spectrum. And you make these fellows interfere. If you take these spectral lines and make them interfere, they will have this sort of a pattern. So then here you have your intensity profile, as it's called. So you can then take this intensity profile and couple it to a fiber. Okay, this is what you want to do. Okay, so in reality, waves are not monochromatic; they are polychromatic. Polychromatic means that you have multiple wavelengths, multiple frequencies, and essentially you can define an envelope on top of these frequencies, and essentially this whole envelope moves together. Okay, so you have even each wave moves and so on. The envelope also moves. Okay, so this is sometimes called a group velocity. Okay, the reason I talk about this envelope of frequencies or this group is because different frequencies can move at different speeds and so on. And there are several cases when you want to consider group velocity. And there's also another thing known as phase velocity. Okay, so phase, I don't want to get deep. It's possible that phase velocity can be faster than the speed of light. Okay, but group velocity is always guaranteed to be less than or equal to speed of light. Okay, so if you look at wave theory and electromagnetic theory, then what happens is that these will start giving you some very funny results. Okay, if you want to try to build splicing, you want to chop up one fiber, take another fiber and couple them together or make a connector and so on, right? The reality is that you have modes which are traveling, modes which are interfering, and modes whose energy, amount of energy is time varying, the dispersion. Okay, so really what you'll see, suppose you sort of stare into a fiber and see what's coming out. Okay, not a very good thing to do, but essentially you see these very fascinating patterns. Okay, and these are known as spectral patterns. Okay, and these, one can actually compute these spectral patterns as solutions of Maxwell's equations based upon all these modes and so on and so forth. So essentially it shows that you have a spatial mode here, this is another mode here and so on and so forth. Okay, based upon how it's reflected and refracted through this network. So if you build a slice, that doesn't, perfectly splice this fiber. Okay, it sort of cuts out this part, right? You lose all this energy, this part. So that's why when you build optical connectors and so on, right? It's possible, since the optic fiber itself is so small, it is possible for you to make a minute error in the splicing, and then you will basically lose a bunch of that energies. And so on. Okay, so this is just to give you an idea of what are the complexities. If an optical engineer needs to understand the effects of these things, and why a good connector can be like really good, whereas a bad connector can be really bad. Okay, so just continuing these ideas. So we've looked at how light interacts with light to give you interference phenomena, and some of the basic light interaction with matter, like the simple stuff, reflection, refraction, diffraction, so on. So we're not going to go into some more ideas in fibers. If I take a fiber and have this light just coupled in, okay, and these are described by eye diagrams. We'll look at this a little more carefully later. These basically describe how cleanly the information you send is coming out. If this thing is scattered such that you cannot cleanly distinguish this eye, you will start making bitter arrays. Okay, eye diagrams are used to study bitter arrays. And so this is a good proxy for saying, let me take the eye diagram here, let me take the eye diagram here, and when it degrades sufficiently, just put an amplifier or put a regenerator. That's the basic idea. And the way this is affected by a number of things. This is affected by attenuation, okay, that is the power or the energy reduces beyond a point where you can't distinguish. It is affected by dispersion. Okay, now dispersion is, remember, is very different from attenuation. Okay, now attenuation, if you like slam more power at the thing, I mean, you can make it, make the initial thing very, very loud, okay. You can sort of handle attenuation by either making it too loud or making the whole fiber low loss, etc. But once you start having dispersion, which happens due to multiple reasons, I mean, there are modal dispersion, chromatic dispersion, so on and so forth, and people have like worked really hard to get rid of dispersion. The reason why people work more harder at dispersion is because the cutting edge of fiber technology is dispersion limited, or what is known as a bandwidth distance product of fiber is dispersion limited. What I mean is that once you start hitting dispersion, you start hitting inter-symbol interference. Okay, I described this process earlier. Once you disperse, right, the energy per bit starts spreading and it will interfere with the next bit. Once you get do that, it doesn't matter how much you crank up the power of the source. You will never be able to distinguish one bit from the other. Okay, so which means you cannot increase your bit rate no matter how much you make your power, infinity. It's also fine. Okay, so dispersion is poses hard limits to bit rates and distances, etc. So dispersion people are really attacked a lot. Okay, now so once you deal with dispersion and attenuation by a mix of careful fiber design and careful transmission, you want to go further and further. So what do? You basically transmit higher and higher powers. Okay, and you take multiple wavelengths and try to get more bandwidth. Okay. You try to pack, you take the spectrum 35 terahertz and then chop it up and put multiple wavelengths, okay, and then you have spectras around that where the information content, each of it is different, okay. Now what happens is when this kinds of things happen, when high power and multiple channels show up, you start hitting non-linearity effects, okay, which even though the medium which has been carefully chosen, silica, to be homogeneous in terms of refractive index and so on, at these high powers, it starts breaking down. I mean, it starts exploiting, it starts exhibiting nonlinear phenomena. Okay, now nonlinear optics, there are full courses in physics, okay, just on that topic. Okay, and then, so nonlinear optics, the funny thing is you can actually exploit nonlinear optics. Okay, and people have shown that one of the limits of nonlinear optics is something known as solitons. You can actually use it, and in a funny mode, you can actually get just a single pulse that goes almost, I mean, undiminished throughout. Okay, so these are quite intriguing, okay, and quite mathematical. So I'm just going to sort of cover it at a conceptual level to pique your interest in this spaces. Okay, so the first thing is, what are the factors that affect attenuation? Okay, this was the first main barrier that was crossed in fiber optics. Okay, so here's a simple way to understand it in ray optics. Okay, so when not really ray optics, when these, when a ray comes here, it'll hit an atom. Okay, now this funny interaction which goes between an atom and this ray, and the atom eats up that ray. Okay, so you can't, there's no postulate of ray optics that describes this. Basically, you can understand this as a photonic effect. This is a packet of energy that shows up at an atom, and the atom has discrete states which are multiple. So if the photon shows up with the right quanta of energy, then the same atom will just gobble it up. Okay, so that is known as absorption phenomenon. Okay, so essentially you want to find that sort of matter that doesn't eat up this thing. So this, the way you understand this in quantum theory is to understand something known as band gap. Okay, so if your band gap is large enough, I mean all the photons, I mean you can view as, I mean conceptually you can think of it as passing through the band gap. Okay, so the photons don't have enough power to take an electron from the lower part of the band and throw it to the higher part of the band, therefore it'll just pass through. That's when the matter will be transparent to those photons. So actually that actually explains why matter is transparent or semi-transparent. Okay, so that's about absorption. Okay, then what can happen is that because you have these light rays which are coming and interacting with this atom, right? Atom is basically this sort of electron fuzzy cloud around it. there's a strong electromagnetic field around it. Okay. So what can happen is that your because light interacts with electromagnetic field, or photon interacts with this field, you can change the direction of the photon. Okay, and this is known as scattering effect. Okay, and this scattering effect is a wavelength dependent effect. It is much, much more pronounced for smaller wavelengths. Okay, which means higher frequencies. So, to give you a simple idea, why is the sky blue? Do you know why the sky is blue? On the rare time I ask a question. Have you ever wondered why the sky is blue, or why is the ocean sometimes green? Why do you, if you go to Miami, why is the ocean green where somewhere else it's blue? Or why is the sky blue? That's simple. Or why is the sky red and sometimes the evening or orange? You know, Einstein once said that you should never lose your sense of wonder. If you do that, you're no longer a student. Okay. Okay, I'll let you wonder about it, okay? But I'll tell you that it has to do with scattering. Okay, so I'll ask you the question next class. Okay, so figure out the answer and come back. Okay, and I also gave you a hint, right? For higher wavelengths, scattering is more research. It depends upon wavelengths, and it depends upon the fourth power of wavelengths. Okay, actually, so it's very much more pronounced for higher wavelengths. It decreases wavelengths. Shorter wavelengths are less scattered, so you want to go to infrared so that you reduce this. And scattering, as you go to far infrared, thing reduces. So actually, you can actually plot this curve and see the scattering. Okay, there's a dominant scattering. There are different types of scattering, Mie scattering, Rayleigh scattering, etc. The Rayleigh scattering is the one phenomenon type of scattering which is dominant. And as you go to higher wavelengths, the effect reduces. Okay, so that is why suppose you want to look at a window. What do I mean by transmission window? Transmission window is that spectral window, or the window of wavelengths, which has good transmission characteristics, which means that I don't have that much attenuation. What does it mean? It means that I don't have that much scattering, or I don't have that much absorption. Okay. So if you look at the absorption curves, right, they also drop nicely along with the wavelengths, and then there's a sort of peak. Okay, this happens because this is a water absorption peak, or OH. Ions are the ones which absorb this thing stuff. They basically absorb here. Okay, and then the material, silica itself, starts absorbing after a point. Okay, so there is it's so funny, okay. The spectrum is so huge, but in spite of 4 decades of engineering, there's been a small piece which has been opened up. Can you believe? The small piece is 35,000 gigahertz. Okay, think of what if you had done some magic and opened up this large piece, what would have been that case? And this is in a small hair-like fiber, okay? And I just want to mention that Lucent in 1999 or 2000, they came up with a fiber that basically eliminated this thing. And they opened up several tens of terahertz bandwidth. So there's a particular fiber they have called an all-wave fiber that even eliminates this OH absorption peak. Okay, so basically the bottom line is in the 1550 nanometer, you see all these are minima. And the bottom line is you have 0.25 dB per kilometer. 0.2 is the Rayleigh scattering, and then you have a little bit of this. 0.25 dB per kilometer. This is the thing. Okay, we'll continue more next class.